This is Tabletop Babble, and I'm Amber. Hello! Today on the show, I chatted with game designer Chris Sellers. We sat down on July 26th to discuss his new game, Raccoon Sky Pirates, which is launching on itch.io, if not already there. We discussed his coming of age with classic tabletop RPGs, the revelation of narrative-based games, and of course, the origin story behind Raccoon Sky Pirates. I'm super excited to play this game. If you know me at all, I'm a goblin at heart, and raccoons are one of nature's many variations of a goblin. If you enjoy chaos and furry little animals, I highly suggest you check it out. But for now, let's talk to Chris. Hi, Chris, and welcome to Tabletop Babble. For my audience, would you please introduce yourself? Tell me your pronouns and like what you've been doing in the TTRPG space.
Hi, my name is Chris Sellers, and my pronouns are he, him, and I'm making games. Yeah, making tabletop role-playing games. This is my first standalone game, but I've been making little things for other people's games, and very excited to be doing it.
Cool. So, of course, I want to know, person to person, do you have a long history with TTRPGs, or are you fairly new to, like, playing and that kind of stuff?
Oh, no, yeah. My history goes back to Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, the Monster Manual for Christmas, things like that, when I was like 12, which was forever ago. Yeah, and I've just been really fascinated with him ever since then.
I have had so little experience with like that old style D&D. Like, I started playing 3.5, and then I think for just fun, we tried to play like AD&D, and I remember stuff where it was like, we basically sat behind bars for like 30 minutes trying to figure out how to break through some bars.
Definitely. They didn't make it easy. And I was fascinated by it. But they didn't make it easy. And I wouldn't say we had a lot of successful games back then. My discovery of narrative games some 5 years ago or so was such just a whole new revelation. Even games that just dabbled in giving players more narrative control, about being more about the story than about all these stats or wargaming, it just blew my mind, and my mind, brain was filled with rainbows and sparkles. It was fantastic. And I've sort of veered into that more and really I'm loving it. And it just seems like it changes the whole center of what role-playing essentially consists of, you know?
I know even just from my 3.5 experience going into the more narrative-focused games, it also blew my mind. I was nervous at first. Like, mm-hmm. I am very open about the fact that I have social anxiety, and going into a table where you're being asked to be creative kind of on the spot and like make up things was very nerve-wracking for me. For you, did you have a similar experience, or was it just natural for you, like when you first started playing narrative role-playing games?
It depended on the group I was with, but I think I was very lucky to have some really good groups that both at home and at cons that really encouraged that kind of and modeled the narrative experimentation and contributing to the story and sort of coaxed me in. I have to say, I still haven't played, Fiasco, for instance, which I think of as sort of a tent pole for some reason in our narrative group. But so there are games I still haven't played, and sometimes it's easier than others, but I just really love that when it goes well, it's everything clicks, and everybody's firing off each other, doing yes and it's really awesome.
Yeah, so I want to know what your first, like, foray was. Like, do you remember what game that was when you first experienced this different RPG style?
I'm looking over at my shelf. I don't remember the first, but, all the PBTA stuff is really fantastic, and I think The first might have been Monster Hearts.
I love Monster Hearts
Yeah,
so
right?
much. Ah.
It's so good.
What's your favorite class? Let me ask this.
Oh.
Okay, we'll go back to class, but were you a player or a GM first for these
Player.
types? Okay. So then,
Yeah.
what was your favorite character class in Monster Hearts?
The witch.
Oh. The witch
Yeah.
is really good. I haven't got to play. I have
So messed
not
up.
gotten to play Monster Hearts yet. I've only
You've been
ever
running
run.
it.
Yeah. I love running it.
It's so good, and there's so much messy emotion in it, and it really invites that. I love the whole range of structure. I love the things that are really locked down, and then the things that are just like, what do you think is going to happen? I love the belonging outside belonging stuff, and there was that Pelgrane book, Seven Wonders, that had some amazing stuff that is really freeform. So anyway, yes, I'm babbling, but I loved it.
No, here on Tabletop Babble, I mean, babble's right
Right.
in the name of the
In
show.
the name.
I want to hear the babble. So Monster Hearts is very dear to my heart because it was like the first game where I was like, okay, I'm going to embrace like getting emotional stuff in it. Like, because sometimes it's kind of scary with, again, social anxiety. Ooh, some baggage about things and sharing feelings and having emotional bleed happen. I'm always interested in how other people experience that stuff because for me, I have such a visceral kind of like apprehension towards it to begin with. So for you, again, I guess it's asking the same kind of question. Did you not have a problem like just jumping right into that emotional stuff?
I experienced bleed long before I heard the term. I guess we all did. And knowing there was a term for it and conversation around it, just that just by itself helped a lot. Just hearing that people were working on tools for processing it. When I was a teenager and I ran my twin brother through a game about with an anti-paladin in it, and like all this stuff came up that I was totally blindsided by. It was terrible. We got in a huge argument, and they don't prepare you for that in Dragon Magazine.
No.
They no, they're like, here's a totally evil character you can build your game around. And anyway, I won't go to the specifics. It was off. I was a terrible DM, and so bleed has been sort of on my mind probably ever since then. And just to know that it's a thing, and it can be good, and it can go either way, and all this stuff is so healthy by comparison. So
For
yeah, it's
sure, because for I wish some of the conversations and tools that we see in the indie space now that are really prevalent that gets talked about, I wish I had it like 10 years ago when I was playing in an all evil campaign
Oh no. Oh
in
no.
our
What was that like?
3.5. It was, well,
You all put
again,
evil characters?
yeah, we all had evil aligned characters,
Ugh.
and it was, again, we had a very good group of people. Everybody had known each other for a really long time.
Yeah.
So we, even before like the term lions or veils or X card was even talked about, we already had a conversation of how evil do we want to be? What is it? What should be depicted? What shouldn't be depicted? What is like, no, we don't want to see. Like even before that kind of conversation was had, I'm glad we did it. But there was times where as a group we had to have check-ins. Again, did not know that there was terms for it, but learning like we didn't like how that went. Let's retcon it,
Wow.
or that made me very uncomfortable, or me realizing that I'm acting out stuff in my personal life through my
Yeah.
character that I'm like, hey guys, was that too far tonight? You know what I mean? But
With
we didn't
evil
have.
characters, you would have to, right?
Yeah,
Like,
and we actually have, for you, Chris, and for listeners too, we've actually run panels at Gen Con about how to run a successful evil campaign. And
nice.
now we talk a lot about checking in, that kind of like conversation, lines and veils, safety tools and stuff. But we were doing it And if it was with any other group of people, I think it could have went really, really bad. So
I had a great group. Some of my closest friends are the people I was in like a 12-year campaign with. And that was maybe my first narrative game, because it was a trad game, but the rules were almost completely disregarded. There were like a few things we rolled for, but mostly we were just talking. And it was because we knew each other so well. But that campaign and the sort of the little games revolving around that group that weren't in that campaign, there was a lot of bleed. And like, we had to check in with each other. I don't think we were quite as healthy as your group. I mean, I love these people dearly. Like I say, they're some of my oldest friends. But like, we didn't have the vocabulary for it. And we were all trying to be badasses, to try to play badasses. And so anyway, yeah.
No, I mean, I made it sound like we were doing good, but this is a 10-year campaign-ish, 7-year campaign. And at the beginning, we had issues, you know? It's like, we ended up taking one of the players, John. I think there was an old, I can't remember. He brings it up all the time. I have forgotten the reference or resource that he mentions to us all the time. Uh-huh. But there's this thing called, like, don't step on each other's shtick. And so we kind of tried to do that for our group. So we were all badasses, but in a specific, unique way. And we all had like a built-in need for each other. So that way we couldn't do the, like, you know, murdering each other. You yes. have what? No, it doesn't matter. You give me that because I'm the wizard. You, Minotaur, do not need this. And there'd be no fighting and no infighting. So
nice.
Yeah. So, okay. So getting back to your experience and like emotional bleed and stuff, kind of like taking your experience from the indie space, learning about, you know, Monster Hearts and stuff like that, what point were you like, oh, I want to start making games?
Oh, like, I mean, I think the desire was there almost immediately. And just like sort of my ambition for how big a project I can take on has grown with each new thing I do. I think it started with wanting to run games and wanting to run games at cons. Which, you know, it's like speed dating. You get a new group of six people every 4 hours. Getting into, especially at Origins and Gen Con, getting into the game you want, if you're a player, is a roll of the dice. And so I just had so much more control over what game I would be in if I ran it. Because then you submit, you pick your time slots. And I think, I don't want to say it's been like a control thing, but it's definitely been like, I know what kind of story it's going to be. I know that it's going to interest me at least, and hopefully other people. And then I think it just, my ambitions expanded from there to be like, I could publish an adventure, or I could write, like I wrote a sort of hack book for Ashen Stars, for a Pelgrim game. And it's like, I like this game a lot. I love this game, but I want to do it in this different context. And so I think that's sort of how it grew, was just from, you know, these games, they fire so many things in your imagination. And I think I just want to pursue that more. If you're playing, you don't always know that your own imagination will be fired. Trying to make it so that it's firing everyone else's imagination is also a hard, very hard thing. But yeah. Anyway, I don't know if that answered your question at all.
No, it does, because I want to talk more about your running games at convention experience, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. I only recently did it right before the pandemic in 2019. I can't remember what it was, fall, a Catacon that's in Ohio. I ran some Ryotama modules that I wrote for the game itself. And that was my first experience running a game at a convention, was also like playtesting my own module.
Oh, wow.
Which is like, I think I kind of go hardcore on myself a little bit. But but for you, were you running your own stuff, or were you running like your like pre-written modules and stuff?
I was mostly running pre-written modules. again, just because of what I could take on. And then, and also I have a real love affair with Pelgrane Gumshoe Games. I think that was the start of my slide toward narrative games. I say slide like it's like this downhill thing, but it's an uphill thing.
Ascent. Your ascent. Graceful ascent.
Yeah. Because as soon as I, because I had played Call of Cthulhu, and I'd played these games where everything stopped dead as soon as you missed your spot hidden roll or whatever. And then when I found out about like Trail of Cthulhu, that you could have this game all centered around the investigation, where that wasn't just this thing off to the side where in fact, that's what really blew my mind, I think, was the first time I saw mechanics written to support the themes of the game. And it's really hard to write a gumshoe adventure. Some people would disagree with me. I think Robin Laws would disagree, but I find it very hard. It's hard to write one, it's hard to run one, because you have to not reveal clues too early. You don't want to spoil all the, I mean, you're supposed to be giving people clues, but they need to be titrated. So I wrote a gumshoe adventure for a con, and that was tough. But then I wrote some cons con games that were not investigation centered, like for Dungeon Crawl Classics. And that was so much easier to run, and the people who would come to those were really goofy. So I think, again, I just sort of did as much as I could handle at any given time, which is not always a lot.
I just want to say, one, I love investigation stuff. One of my friends runs the co-host of Tabletop. That will, because I keep adding co-hosts. John is really into... Yeah. Like Delta Green, Call of Cthulhu, that kind of investigation focused stuff. And yeah, I think I would be afraid to run something like that just because of what you said, like the whole, like, it's supposed to be investigation. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to show too much, but you also have to get people to go into their, like, the reveal seems very difficult. Also, I love Dungeon Crawl Classics. That is just an excuse to be a ridiculous, silly character who's, you know, is going to die. So
yes, as those zero level funnels are so great. The word that always comes to mind for me with the Dungeon Crawl Classics is gonzo.
Yes.
It's totally wacky and weird. It's just, yeah.
It's so fun because, like, for me, I'm sorry, I want to share this with you, Chris. It's like, no. I feel bad because, like, on Tabletop Babble, I feel like I'm supposed to be really interviewing, like, the person and showcasing them, and I end up being like, blah, 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 me. But no, I love it because I think Dungeon Crawl Classics and, like, Death Trap Dungeons, like, gave me permission to be, like, it helped me grow as a role player. Which is funny because it's not a lot of role playing opportunities per se.
Right.
But I could just be a silly character who speaks in a weird wizard voice.
Uh-huh.
And I wouldn't have to worry about the table, like, judging me. Isn't that weird? It's just.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know. Did you find there was something that made it easier about that, that they were these sort of really well-established role-playing game tropes?
Yes.
The wizard, the elf, whatever.
Yeah, that too. And then I could just really lean into it really hard. Mm-hmm. That character was obviously going to get disintegrated in, like, you know, 10 minutes. So it's not even going to be a big deal that he is just this very distilled trope or whatever I was playing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, no, I have a friend who whose character was a disciple of, I don't think this was the DCC, this was Astonishing Swordsman of Sorcerer's Hyperborea, but he was a devotee of some frog god, like the Thagua or something. and we ran into the situation where it was possible that this ancient deity might come back. And he just paused to be like, can I just stop and make sure we all agree how awesome that would be? And we're like, no, that'd be terrible. and just, you could really lean into it with these OSR games that are kind of evoking 1930s pulps or 1970s D&D, but in this really pulpy way. And you could just really lean into it. I just really like that a lot.
I kind of miss doing death traps and stuff sometimes. I do miss conventions. I can't wait to start going back to conventions. Yeah.
They're happening online.
Do you do
the online thing?
Well, I see. I spend so much time on my computer. It just, I miss. I'm an introvert, but playing the in-person game we got to play a couple weeks ago, I was like, oh my gosh. I forgot what it's like to be in a room with other people.
I don't know if there are pheromones or what, but actually being around the same table is really different.
It is. It truly is.
And I've been playing a lot of games on the Gauntlet. I don't know if you do the Gauntlet.
No. What's Gauntlet?
Online role-playing game community. Mm-mm. They're super into safety tools and open table and consent. And they're really protective of all their players because most of the time you're playing, well, not most of the time, but a lot of time you're playing with strangers. This is just a big group. And they post these games online, notices that they're going to be coming. And you can, anybody who's a member can sign up. I think you become a member by supporting their Patreon. I've just really gotten into it because they are so respectful of everybody. It's like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood of games. I shouldn't say that because it makes it sound bland. It's not. It's really awesome. So many imaginative people. So many people playtesting their games there. Anyway, cool. I'm really grooving on it. I love it. It's all online. And I think I got into that right before the pandemic happened.
Ooh.
And I was like, well, I guess we're all online now. But I love being around a table with people, and I loved doing it at a con with, like I said, the speed dating of new six people every 4 hours. And I'm really introverted, and I don't understand it. Why? Maybe it's because there's structure around it, but how can I be so introverted and still really get into, I guess they say introverts like having really intense conversations one-on-one. And this was a little bit like that.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I don't do well in, like, large parties. Like, conventions do take a lot out of me, and I'm always looking for, like, these off rooms to go sit and decompress and then come back out. But I say I'm an introvert. It's true. Like, I lose energy when I'm with people, but I still love people. Like, I love being with people that, like, groove together. Like, you get a good group. And it's these, and I think you nailed it too. Like, I love that we're going to be sitting down and I have this structure in front of me and I know the social expectations for this thing that we're doing. And there's no free fall, no like weird, like walking around a room looking for an animal to pet. It's just, we're going to be playing a game and it's got and it's going to be 3 hours. I know when it's supposed to be done. I know when I'm going to be home.
Yes, totally. There's no awkward small talk. Your characters might have awkward small talk, and that's totally different.
And I'm really good at playing the awkward small talk character because I have a lot of life experience to draw upon.
That's so great. God, I love role-playing games, and I love the embrace of weirdness. Like, I used to think, oh, LARP, that's what weirdos play. And now I'm like, no, Chris, you're a weirdo. They're a weirdo. We're all weirdos. And LARP is beautiful. And I don't think there could be any form of role playing now that I would like be anything less than curious about.
It's so funny. I had to pull back from my microphone because I was laughing so hard at that because I literally told my best friend, Josh, who co-owns Geekspective with me, I literally told him, was like, I will never play Dungeons and Dragons. That's too nerdy. Too nerdy for me, a nerd. And then he's like, I don't know, Amber. You like comics and storytelling. You'd really like this. I'm like, mm-mm. And then I get into it. I'm like, true dungeon? I'll never do a true dungeon. No way.
Oh, here's my line. Oh, really? I'll just push that line a little farther back.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I feel like the only just thing for me to do now is to admit there are no lines, at least for me personally. I mean, I don't know. There's probably a line somewhere. But with the right group, I think there would be nothing I wouldn't.
I mean, I used to think I would never be into like war gaming, like the original stuff.
Are you doing that? Like with the tape measures on a table?
My partner is really into heavy gear. Like,
really?
So into heavy gear. And he's super introverted. Like, I'm an introvert, but he's like another step out. And I love him dearly. So if he asked me to sit down and we're going to play heavy gear, I would do it for him.
Right on. Right. I feel so much love in that statement. That's so great. I'm friends with a really creative guy named Peter who lives in Washington, who has kind of raised wargaming figures and terrain to an art form. He recycles bits of trash into and like glues them onto other figures to make just totally weird, unexpected things. And he has whole narratives. So he'll rock up at a wargaming con with his own army that he unpacks out of the foam box, and they're like, you know, the 435th engineers, and they've got elephants but they've got like, you know, like he'll make little robots out of wire and the terrain he makes. And there's a story behind all of it. Like he has a story for the army, and he's not trying to min max the points or anything. He's really just trying to make the most interesting stuff. And so I can't even turn my nose up at wargaming because he's shown how cool.
I think when you see people who are, I want to say it this way, like they are openly passionate in the sense that they are not like gatekeepers either. Like they just are like, this is my jam. I'm really into it. I would love to share it with you if you listen. I just am so into people who are like way into their thing, but in like a very, like I said, a very open way, like wouldn't be like, you know, like say kind of gatekeepery about it. And that is just, I don't know. Like, again, I probably won't ever get into, you know, wargaming 100%, but I am just completely fascinated and my house is full of it. So
awesome.
Ready for a rules light, narrative failing forward, collaborative storytelling tabletop role playing game?
Unsure of where to start?
Powered by the Players is an actual play podcast featuring mini campaigns and one shots of all your favorite Powered by the Apocalypse games.
Each campaign or one shot will be a different PBTA game with a rotating cast of diverse players. We've got Masks, a teenage superhero drama.
Bluebeard's Bride, a feminist horror retelling.
Monster of the Week, a supernatural mystery.
Escape from Dino Island, a Jurassic Park inspired adventure.
Crossroads Carnival, a Depression era sideshow noir.
The next game we play could be yours. So join Morgan, Kristen, and Diana.
And let's power up.
Follow us on Twitter at PBTPlayers.
Subscribe on your favorite podcatcher.
You were talking about, like, you love role-playing games because of weird premises. Let's talk about why I was like, yes, Chris, I want to talk to you. Which is Raccoon Sky Pirates.
Woo! Raccoon Sky Pirates. Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. You and your friends play a crew of raccoons who live in the junkyard and build a flying ship out of trash you find in the junkyard. And you fly it across town to the suburbs and raid an upper middle class house for all of their trash, which is to say their Roombas and their juicers and PlayStations, and try to fly back to the junkyard with it without the ship exploding and without the neighborhood watch taking you down. And it's just sort of a game of random action, right? Because you roll to see what you're going to do, not whether you succeed at what you do. So you're a raccoon and what you do is pretty much random. So you're rolling to see that, and then you weave a story out of what you wanted to do, what you ended up doing, and what else is going wrong. And hopefully the way it's built is that just the chaos builds and builds until things go horribly wrong. Yeah.
I love it. I love these Katamari raccoons so much that I want to play it so badly. Okay, so I will get more into like mechanic stuff a little bit, but I kind of want to know like why? What was the inspiration? What was like Raccoon Sky Pirates?
I mean, literally, my partner and I were woken up by the dogs middle of the night last September, and the dogs run to the back door of our upstairs, which leads onto this balcony, and we look out there. I couldn't see anything because I was half asleep, but my partner sees all these raccoons on our balcony who are like picking up little things and looking at them and setting them down very deliberately and pooping in the flower beds and then trying to get inside. And she told me enough about it, and I was there for the experience, even though I didn't see it, that it just fired my imagination of like, oh my God, these were These were a troop. They were a pirate crew. They had descended down some anchor line to our balcony, and you know, if they'd gotten inside, who knows what would have happened. And I just felt so much terror, but also kinship with these raccoons. I had to fill out the rest of the story.
Yeah. I think raccoons are one of nature's goblins, like our reality's goblins. So of course, me, the goblin lover, is like, yes, I want to play. I mean, I can totally see it. One of my favorite raccoon stories is I had a raccoon experience where I went camping and we had cooked, I don't know, some sort of meat in a pan out on the fire pit. And we only went into, we're starting to get stuff set up in our tent. Like we were only in the tent for maybe like, I don't know, 5 minutes trying to like set up how we're going to sleep and how everybody was going to be arranged. And then we hear this horrible clattering outside. We all run out and there's a raccoon who like looks at us, looks down at the ground where the frying pan was at, looks back up at us, grabs the frying pan and runs. Just dragging the frying pan behind it.
Oh, that's so awesome. Oh, wow.
And I was like, the audacity of this mammal.
And they're so expressive. The look up, the look down, I was never here. And then it just trundles off. Clunk, 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 clunk. Not subtle at all. Yeah. They're amazing. Yes. So, you know, I tend to anthropomorphize everything. It's like I see the world with everything with googly eyes on it. And they are so easy to anthropomorphize. Having said that, in the game, there's only a little bit of anthropomorphization. They're pretty much raccoons. But you were talking about goblins. And first of all, I wish I could have been there for the camping thing. That's amazing. It reminds me of my sister-in-law had said that she was leading a bunch of kids on a camping trip once. And they ran into like this whole knot, this passel of raccoons, and they were, she was physically afraid for their safety, because she said if you get enough raccoons together, they equal a bear, and they think they're bears, and they're, you know, they're totally fearless. So anyway, one day I will go out camping and have my own raccoon story to tell. But that yours is awesome. What you're saying about goblins makes me think of, well, a couple things. Space Goblins by Vidicio Voletti was one of the inspirations for this game. And where you're just like making a ship out of Legos, and you're just, there was all this valorization of trash, which I really love. And then, do you know Evry Alder's whole thing with goblins?
No, I don't.
She had a tweet, I think, that was like all about how being goblin-y means being in community that's messy and that values messiness and is values people not in spite of their uneven emotional growth, but because of it. And I was reading this and it just really made me feel all the feels. And if my raccoons can approximate anything like that, it will be a really great thing.
I think that's why I identify with goblins so hard. Because of the fact, I think they're like self, in my head, goblins are very self-aware. They know what they are, right? Uh-huh, and they don't, they're not ashamed of what they are and what they do or how they behave. As somebody who lives with depression and anxiety, it's kind of nice to have this like little physical, like this little avatar of a fantasy creature that I can kind of like look to and be inspired by. Like, you know that you're trash, but that's okay. And you do your best. You do your goblin best.
You're never going to be Legolas on surfing on a shield, you know?
No.
But who wants that? That's just showy. No, you're a goblin. And you're gonna do your goblin best. I love that.
And so I think so. Yeah. So raccoons to me are like they fit in that goblin bucket, the goblin bucket of creatures. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the actual game. So I want to know: is it set up in a way that you just play it as a one shot, or could you do like a multiple session thing with the same cohort of goblins or cohort of raccoons?
There are some rules for going out again. So there's five scenes that take you from the beginning of the raid to the end, but then you can improve the ship, and you can improve your own individual list of actions, because everybody has a different list of 12 actions that they roll for. And so there are progression mechanics built in. There's a little, because one of the stretch goals was not your first trash rodeo. So I promised people I'd put in mechanics for going out again. So you can. You can go out with the same raccoons or different raccoons. You can go out with possums. There's a whole possum expansion. This was supposed to be a tiny zine, and it turned into a big thing. But anyway, yes is the answer to your question.
Yes, good. As a person who is very interested in this game now, eventually I'm going to run it. And I want to know, like, as the creator, how would you talk me through how I, as a GM, would run this game?
So there's no GM.
It's, oh, really?
Place a raccoon. Yes.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
They're so lovingly anarchic that I have a GM kind of would have been wrong.
Okay. Yeah.
But since you're going to be the person reading the rules, you'll probably be facilitating it. So you'll just sort of keep things moving along. But there's a little blurb about sort of five things to keep in mind as the person facilitating. So it's just mostly about keeping people moving through the scenes. But the scenes are pretty structured. Because there's no GM, there's a lot of structure.
Okay, cool.
I actually had to undo some of the structure because it was becoming a board game.
Oh.
So I tried to aim for that sweet spot.
Okay, cool. Because like I thought I saw something that there were cards, or did you have like an
obvious... Yes, there are cards. There are totally cards. The cards are for introducing complications in the game. You can play with poker cards, but it's easier if you play with the cards I'm getting printed up. But I mapped them all to poker cards.
How many people would you say, or how many raccoons could be in the horde?
Your little cohort? Six is what I designed for. But because there's also six possums and six other trash animals, rats, pigeons, and roaches, you could potentially play with more.
Again, I always wish I was recording video and I put video out there, because sometimes my guests come on and say things and I like lose my mind, and then they get to see me go like do basically a Muppet, like, listener, basically I turned into a Muppet Amber and my jaw unhinged and I threw my head backwards when I heard pigeons and roaches.
You kind of did. Ah! It was great.
So you can be a group, not just six raccoons. You could just be a group of
You could be a group of six possums, or you can mix it up. You know, it's balanced. I say balanced loosely, but it's made so that if you're the six possums or the six raccoons, everybody has different actions that are likely to be helpful or not. Oh, it doesn't matter. You could play with all 18 of them if you wanted to. It'd be great.
Oh, you could do a huge, like, actual LARP. You could turn this into a LARP and do it in a...
Oh, now you're blowing my mind. Yes.
I'll put raccoon makeup on. I mean, I already got the kind of dark circles from never sleeping, so... I love the relationships, too. Like, I'm just going to read out loud I have the PDF up. Chris was kind enough to send it to me before the interview. Unfortunately, did not get to read it before, but... I am looking at it now. But like Brisket Jack is a character that name that I know Dave, my editor for Tabletop Babble, would love. Maria Triple XL.
Yes.
The Colossus, strong, deaf, and brave. So yeah, what are like skills, I guess? Is that what you call them?
Yeah, so there are approaches. So I wanted it to be totally random what you end up doing, but I had to have some way of working out whether what you do is going to be helpful or not. Because if it's not helpful, it's ticking up the disaster meter toward things blowing up or the residents waking up. So I had to make it not the player's choice about whether it was helpful or not. So what you do is first you say which approach you're using, and each raccoon has a different, or each animal has a different three approaches to choose from. And then you roll, and you've got a 50-50 chance of your roll matching an action that's matches your approach or not, that is tagged with your approach or not. So, for instance, if you're Brisket Jack, you might choose Deft, I think is one of his. Then you roll a 12-sided die and you check your list on your character sheet. And if the action that you rolled has Deft next to it, then what you did is helpful. And you get to see how it's helpful in the scene.
Okay.
If it's not there, then it's unhelpful and you got to see how things get worse.
I'm now interested in knowing your, so there's a list of actions as well.
Yes.
Okay.
And and there are some actions that every raccoon shares with each other and some actions that are unique. So, and multiple raccoons can help out in a given, doing a given thing where you all roll. And then if you don't like your roll, you can take somebody else's roll. Somebody else's die result. But yeah, I don't know if I answered your question.
Yes, yeah, you did. Because like you have your action list that relate, those actions relate to something, relate to your approach.
Yeah.
And then you can do group things as well. And then I was now just scrolling through because ADHD and saw that the chart for the complications as well for the cards, which is really cool to say, like you draw the two of hearts and there's a pet. Or something like that. All horizontal surfaces in common rooms are covered in an obstacle course of fragile, noisy tchotchkes. Oh no, all of my anime figurines.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, right. So there's different things. And if you want to make your unhelpful action helpful, you can draw a card. You can play a card. You have a cards in your hand. You can play one. But then you can only do that once per scene. And so, see, there's all this board gamey structure in there, which helps structure things, like I say, because you're raccoons and everything's unstructured otherwise. But what happens is if you can't play a card and you roll an unhelpful action, and there's a card already played that matches a certain, you know, card type, then things get even worse. So there's a push your luck kind of thing to it. Basically, if there's a card that matches the disaster meter, the next thing on the disaster meter, then you mark just not just one problem, but two problems. And so things sort of snowball.
End state of game. It's what can happen. Like you have this disaster meter. What happens when you fill up the disaster meter?
So there's two disaster meters. There's one in the house. And when that one fills up, the residents and the dog all wake up and the cat's already there. The cat's sort of an ambiguous character. But anyway, they all wake up and the residents get out the broom and they chase you out. And everybody does one last action to get back on the ship and leave. It just sort of curtails how much of a haul you can bring it. But if the disaster meter on the ship gets all the way up, then the ship overheats and it blows up and you lose all your trash.
No!
And everybody's fine. You know, nobody really gets hurt in this game. It's kind of slapstick. But you lose all your trash and that stuff.
Not my precious trash. That's the, as Amber, as the player characters I've played, my items are so important to me and all of my characters. Well, not all of them, but Amber,
and again,
metagame, cares about her items.
Right. And when I say trash, of course, like I said before, everything is trash.
Yes.
The PlayStation is trash. The rusty box spring from the bed is trash. It's all trash.
Have you ever heard of or played the game The Warren?
Yes.
Okay.
I love The Warren. Yeah.
I've
read it. I haven't played it.
Okay. Yeah, all right. So another game I've never played but have always run. Dear listener, it's all rabbits. And I think my favorite thing is because there is a GM for that game. Whereas you get to describe things to rabbits. And I recently ran a session for The Warren of Petal Grove, which will be coming out. Episodes will be coming out soon. And I had humans making a festival and it was just like glorious trash everywhere for them. And it was so fun for the rabbits to get into that kind of stuff. And it also brought sorts of other animals too.
Oh, nice. That can be good and bad if you're a rabbit.
Yes, it could be good or bad. My rabbits for that season were all conspiratorial. So they were conniving.
So great.
Okay. So I'm enamored. You, Chris, know, you can see me. And I'm sure listeners can hear. I think you guys should check out this game. I'm eventually going to run it. So watch for that on Twitter.
Awesome.
But this was your first published game that is yours.
Yes. And the first full game that I wrote. I I am writing this other game. It's like a queer sword and sorcery game that I really have a lot of feels for it also. But if you've never, I don't know, if you've never written, have you written a game? If you like,
no, CGX? I'm perpetual notes in a Word doc that is.
That's the thing. It's a huge undertaking, and it can snowball, it can get away from you. And so then this local group I'm a part of in Columbus, Ohio, Story Games Columbus, they're also lovely, and we were doing in-person things right until the pandemic hit. And as a sort of care package for everybody, the organizer asked if I had any games I wanted. So I had this sort of 6-page Ashcan version of Raccoon Sky Pirates that I put together for him, and it took like a month, and he distributed it to like however many people are in this group. And that was like December of 2020. And then right after that, ZineQuest came along on Kickstarter. So I shelved Defy the Gods, the sword and sorcery thing, and poured all my energy into Raccoon Sky Pirates because it seemed doable, you know, it seemed manageable. It was a zine, I'd already done it. I had already play tested it a glorious once. And I was like, oh, I've got this in the bag, this is great. And reader, it was not in the bag. It ended up being a whole lot more work after that, but at least it seemed doable. So yeah, this is my first game. And because I'd already run it and had good experiences with it, I thought, okay, this I can do, you know, this is a chunk I can bite off. And it was a zine, so like, it is a zine.
I think it's interesting the connotation like zine comes across, where it's all, oh, it's going to be this light thing that you're going to be putting together. But then as you realize, oh, this is actually a lot of thought effort goes into making it seem like it's a light, easy thing to do.
Totally. Yeah. When I say it's a zine, it was more like I had this idea, like you say, of what a zine signifies, not how much work actually goes into one.
Yeah. And did you get it physically printed as well?
He got the 6-page Ashcan physically printed. I am going to have this one physically printed. I'm making the PDF available to Kickstarter backers next month. And it'll be this month when this airs. It probably actually will be on itch by the time this airs.
Okay.
So, because I'm so close. So the PDF will be available, and then I'll get it printed downtown and send that out in December when the stretch goals are ready. so like, not only did the zine become huge, it's like 52 pages, most of which is handouts. But then I was like, I think I emailed you about this before, but like, it was my first Kickstarter. And again, I wouldn't have done it if it hadn't been like, oh, it's a zine. After it funded, I was like, well, I have to have stretch goals. And the first two stretch goals were writing stretch goals, which was hard enough, like amplifications to the rules, like adding possums and adding campaign play, you know, I don't know the word campaign, but you know, repeat play. But then the next two were like, there'll be a deck of cards. I had never had one printed up before. You know, there'll be a special 12-sided raccoon die with a raccoon face for the 12. And I didn't know how to get one of those made. The die, it turns out the only place you can get a custom 12-sided die made is a Q Workshop in Poland. And that's the only place on the planet that I could find. And so that's happening, but it's going to be December before it's ready. So anyway, sorry, the answer to your question is yes, I'll have it printed up, but it's waiting on all this other amazing stuff that made it so much more than a zine, when a zine is already hard enough.
Well, you get excited, you know, like, especially if people are enthusiastic about something and you want to like give something more, especially if you're funding and you're doing well, you know, people are backing it. I get it. It's like, I think sometimes it feels like you have to have stretch goals.
Yeah,
I'm like,
right.
I'm going to get ready to do a Kickstarter here in September, and it's for a game, and we are trying. I'm like, we got to be conservative.
Right.
Stretch goals, we need to make sure we can actually physically do these things first, because yes. I've had stuff when I do enamel pins where it's like, there are hidden things everywhere that you don't know or expect. I have two questions for you. And okay. Let's see if I can remember the second one after you answer the first one. who can say if it will happen? First question is, I always ask writers and designers this because I'm interested in knowing, like, for you personally, what part of this process has been challenging for you? Is it the writing? Is it the... I know what it is for me. I don't want to sit down. I don't have focus. I can't sit down and write.
I think the hardest thing has been putting it in front of playtesters, especially because on the Gauntlet, there are often people I don't know very well. You know, I know them sort of parasocially online, but not really. Just to put something in front of them that is incomplete and that may not actually always be fun, you know? Fortunately, a lot of people get a lot out of just playtesting a game like that. For them, that process is fun in a meta way. But, you know, if the game falls flat, things like that, that's hard. But it's the only way to actually make a game, I've learned. Like, but it's so hard because I feel like I'm imposing on people, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I am shy, really.
I actually wouldn't have known because I feel like we're doing pretty good. Too shy.
We're
people.
Doing great.
Yeah, it feels
yes,
great.
Right.
For me, I think it's the perfectionism part. Like, it's not so much I'm worried about people taking and imposing, but more like for me, it's I don't like things being in a flux state. But I want, because my vision's not complete.
Yes. Right. Because your vision is always going to be way out ahead of what you actually make.
Yeah, and I think that's
where
even
I'm at the end product. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's where I'm at right now with my Ryutama module. I have two of them written, and I love Ryutama a lot. You talked about how you love investigation games and Gumshoe.
Yeah.
I love exploration in games. I love games like puzzle adventures, like Monkey Island and that kind of stuff, or like think even like the early, you know, computer games for kids that were like Putt-Putt Saves the Zoo or, you know, Pajama Sam.
Yes.
Those games I love. I love exploring. I love clicking on things. I love like trying to find items. And so Ryutama, I've turned Ryutama, that game system works for me for that kind of style of play. And I have two modules that are built like that. Like, you have to find the rope to go here and do this thing and that thing. And
nice.
I'm at that state where it's just like, I just need to shit or get off the pot, you know?
yeah. It's hard. It's hard. Like, being a perfectionist is hard because, the blank piece of paper is as perfect as it's going to get. Everything else is marring it. So it's never going to match my inward vision. You know, those three, like for me, for the raccoons, the words Raccoon Sky Pirates conjures up so much. And I think, fortunately, you know, I was lucky that in the minds of other people, it conjures up a lot too. Will the actual game ever approach what people can already imagine? You know, people roll up to your game with the most valuable part of the game inside themselves, their own, you know, imaginations. And so all of which is just to say perfectionism sucks and I'm sorry and that you are dealing with this and that you should get this in front of people.
Yeah,
like, I
know.
Totally play that game.
I've run it for lots of people. I've run it for lots of people. Just
okay.
Say that.
Oh, awesome.
But my
awesome
thing is I haven't given it to other people to run for other people, right?
Oh, God, yes.
That's the thing that is preventing me because it's still in that state of like, this is really just Amber knowledge, right? Like, I have intimate knowledge of how this should go and I need to write my glorified notes into an actual thing. But Chris and dear listener, I am trying to get to it. 2022. I say this
excellent
every year. This 2022 will be my year for this module. We'll see.
Or 2021. It's only half over.
Yeah, that's true. We'll see. I've been really busy.
Fair. Totally fair.
I've been burning the candle at like, I said the other day on Twitter, I was like, I feel like some people are burning the candle at both ends. I feel like I have this wheel spoke of a candle and it's all on fire.
Oh, God. Oh.
Oh. It's just me. It's okay.
It's fine.
It's really fine. Yeah, it's the dog, you know, the fire all around, drinking coffee.
Yes.
I'm fine. It's totally cool. Okay. I made a note and I remember my second question.
Right on.
I want to know, do you have any Kickstarter takeaway lessons learned for Zine Quest that you would like to maybe impart onto people who are be interested in making a zine?
Yeah, keep it simple. It's a zine. If you make it too complicated, you get past that sort of punk DIY spirit that all zines come from. And maybe also plan for things to not go well, but also plan for what you're going to do if things go really well, so that you know ahead of time and you're not making decisions when you're kind of in this euphoric haze. And I think it can be hard to do that, to plan for both of those. Like, emotionally, I was equipped only to plan for failure or to plan for barely scraping by. Decide what your stretch goals are going to be ahead of time and don't deviate from those. And I like the simple stretch goals, he said, now having done the hard stretch goals, or some of them. I know they get much harder than what I did. I like the stretch goal where you pay all your contributors more. I don't have any contributors. It's just me. But
are you doing all the art too?
Yeah. Yeah.
God. Yeah. You guys, the art looks so good. There's this picture staring at where these raccoons are up on a roof and they're looking down. They all look like they're good, up to no good. And I love it. It's very evocative. It's really good.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. But if there are no other contributors, then that is just all the more reason to keep it simple. What?
I'm looking at the raccoons that you've drawn. Chris says, what? Because I'm pretty sure I was looking to the right off camera aww. And it's just this raccoon who's stuck outside of the side of his ship, and it's a toilet lid.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. Well, everything's repurposed, you know.
Yes, yes.
It's sort of a porthole. But yeah, anyway, that was the answer to your question. Yeah.
Yes. Chris, I am so excited. I'm so glad I remembered to check Tabletop Babble email, and I saw your email, and I got to see this game and get to talk with you. For listeners, can you please let people know where they can find you, where they can find this game?
Yes, I am at Hectic Electron on Twitter and Instagram. My website is hecticelectron.com. You can find this game, probably by the time this comes out, will be in PDF form on itch at hecticelectron.itch.io. So it's all Hectic Electron all the way down.
Hectic Electron, HECTICELECTRON. Got it.
Got it.
Because I just followed you. Awesome. So yeah, thanks again so much. I'm excited for your future stuff too. I know you mentioned sword and sorcery stuff, so.
Yes, later. Probably much later.
Yes, maybe 2022.
2022 is my year. Yes.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Amber. Thanks so much. Take care.
Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the show. You can find me on Twitter at RocketOrca, Kenny is at Volfmere, and John is at CrosswaysGM. Tabletop Babble is part of the Geekspective Network. Go to geekspective.com to check out all our other shows or follow us on Twitter at Geekspective. Our theme music was provided by the Battle Bards.